This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
I'm so proud of you, Nathan. You got it straight again. You got the order straight.
I stuttered like the word between those, so you can see my brain.
I had high hopes that in 2021 we would get over this.
All right. Well, all's well. Things going well.
All yep, right.
We're chipping away at our book. We're making some good progress.
And more than chipping away.
Yeah, we are.
It's been a big week around here in Bookland.
Yes. What book are you talking about? I forgot about this book.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Got it. So, all right.
All right.
Well, what's up? What else is new?
Well, you know, I did a recap show a couple weeks ago for end of 2020. And in there, we heard Dr. Hawk's musings throughout the year, some of my favorite clips of Dr. Hawk, some of Dr. Lyle's favorite clips. And one of the clips was her praising Jimmy the guitar player. And and so it just so happens that in episode 244, we had Dr. Hawk described Jimmy the guitar player, but this time with a more pejorative twist, which is washed up Jimmy. So
No. This is a mischaracterization. It's not what happened. There's no one Jimmy the guitar player whose character I was impugning on the show. I was speaking of Jimmys who happen to be washed up. That does not describe our devoted Jimmy the guitar player, nor many, many successful Jimmys who are pursuing their passions and interests in a variety of ways.
And with a variety of women.
And with a variety of women, as is their right in life.
That's a great point, and I stand corrected. Yeah. I may have mischaracterized it. So yeah, well, right. that's what I meant to say.
Good. There you go.
Setting the record straight.
Exactly. So you were describing the kind of Jimmy that the listener actually was interacting with, which is just some washed up Jimmy that was not doing her right. Not treating her right. God, I'm sorry.
Oh, Jesus.
No, that was a total accident. All right.
Clearly, it's just time to just end the show.
I was searching not doing right by her. That's what
there
I was
you
looking
go.
For.
That's pretty good.
You're making it worse. You're just
All right.
Well, lo and behold, I got a voicemail. I got a voicemail from Washed Up Jimmy, who had some interesting things to say to you, Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle. Mm-hmm. So I've queued it up in your – I've sent you guys a link. So please please press play.
Yeah, hi. This is Jimmy, the guitar player from Canada. And I just wanted to let you know that I was very offended by some comments that were made about Jimmy's on the podcast a few weeks ago. You know, some of us really do have a lot of potential. And it seemed like you were questioning our intelligence. And I don't think the fact that I had to look up the word wastrel in the dictionary means that I'm lacking as such, because every other Jimmy I know had never heard of the word either. So, and it says here, Webster's defines it as a wasteful or good-for-nothing person. And I just think, with all the potential that I have, there's no way that could be true. And my mom agrees with me. And also, it says it could mean a waif or a neglected child. And I can tell you that those chili cheese dogs at the open mic, they don't eat themselves. And I'm 35, so I'm not a child or a waif. And I just think an apology is in order. Thanks.
Well, I suppose I, you know, apologies where they are owed. Clearly, you know, there's a bell curve of potential. And we are dealing here with a very high potential Jimmy. So I, all apologies are due. I stand corrected.
That was very cool. That was well done. Yeah, that's a, that's a first class Jimmy right there. We got a really great one. All good.
Well,
all right. Good.
Speaking of washed up Jimmy, we've actually a question of one of our listeners. And this was a discussion between our listener and a friend who identifies as a washed up Jimmy.
Ah. So, okay.
Dear doctors, I think he means Dr. Hawk, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Dear doctors, my friend who identifies as a washed up Jimmy took offense at episode 244. He felt that the doctors were undervaluing washed up Jimmy's potential contribution to a relationship. At first, I found his grumblings silly, but as the conversation progressed, he made an interesting point. In a society that is bringing women into the workplace and displacing men in the process, there will inevitably be more and more relationships with higher earning females. As evolutionary psychologists, we can see that this will run afoul of our ancient attraction circuits. But isn't this a necessary trade-off of the gender equality movement? If women in the workforce must status settle, end quote, on a lower earner, why not have a washed-up Jimmy as opposed to a low-earning Horace? Low-earning Horace can neither provide sexuality nor security. Maybe this is why this is a recurring dynamic in Dr. Hawk's practice. The conversation got me thinking that perhaps a society that adheres to traditional gender roles is more conducive to viable romance.
Very intelligent and fun. Let's look at some things. The truth of the matter is it the society sort of never really changes. You continue to wind up with the same dynamic. So the woman doesn't say, well, gee, now that I make $80,000 a year, now what I think I'm going to do is I'll just go ahead and go down to somebody who makes $35,000 as a guitar player, and because he's hot. No, she's going to want somebody that makes $125,000. So that's how it works. So the female admiration mechanism, you know, her head rocks back and she's looking to look up a little bit. That's just how it is. Now, so as women, women have been making a very good livings relative to men for a long time. It doesn't change the dynamic. So each individual woman has her own payoff matrix that is that's consistent with her personal life circumstances and her personality. And so very often, so they don't basically say, oh, I have, you know, say some gal that that makes $200,000 a year definitely does not say, oh, well, then fine, no problem. I'm just going to fish for the most entertaining, best-looking guy that I can find. That's not what she does. She still looks for provisioning, okay? And so, and typically is looking to her peer group is how that works. Somebody that is her peer, that because he's a male, he's working like hell, and he's working 10 or 15% harder than she's working, and he's out-earning her. So he's probably a little bit older. So all of these things still wind up with the same kind of dynamic and differential up and down the food chain. Now, so the trade-off, it isn't the case that that there aren't relationships where the female makes more than the male. There are. It turns out that in cases where that's true, they're more likely to divorce, by the way. In other words, so the female is sort of running this CB, and the CB runs all over the place given an individual female circumstances, and it winds up being effectively a two-factor equation, and we don't, you know, we never get rid of it. It's just sort of a constant. Jen, your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind for me. It's not, you know, you don't have women who are suddenly thrown into the workforce and high achieving on par with men who it's this all or nothing proposition. Oh, if I can't find someone in my peer group who has comparable provisioning abilities and comparable intelligence and everything else, then, oh, I'm just going to suddenly switch on a bunch of latent casual mating circuits and go for the Jimmy rather than look for the best pair bond that I could find. So, yeah, she's most likely still going to be, you know, if it is some sort of, if she's got some sort of specialty job where I can't even think what field this would
right.
be, where women are systematically out earning the men. You know, she's still certainly,
maybe
it seems like
teachers.
The opposite would be true. Well, yeah. Okay. But you know, she's got more, if she's looking to date within her peer group among kindergarten teachers, she has a big, you know, big marketing problem anyway. Although my kindergarten teacher was male, which is, I always was really Mr. Rocky. He was fantastic. It's a rare thing to find a male kindergarten teacher. But most of the time, if she's, you know, she's sort of high achieving and looking within her work and peer group, she's going to be outnumbered by men in most of these fields. So I don't see this as being a huge problem, and the female mating process is not such that it's just gonna throw in the towel and be like, oh, I'm gonna go for the hot guitar player because I just give up on this process. So if it's someone who makes 5,000 less a year than her, that's still better than completely abandoning a parabond entirely and downgrading to a Jimmy. That said, of course, there are women who have more casual mating circuits in general, and women who are, you know, whether it's through a kind of dynamic process where they've been sensitized to it with dating apps and everything else, where the Jimmies are omnipresent on the dating apps, and that's who's giving them the most positive feedback, that could contribute to some of this process too. But yeah, I don't see this as being a huge problem.
And
Melly doesn't either. That's why she had to scratch in the background there.
It's more of an entertaining question than it is anything else. I.e., why don't the chicks just if they're going to do really well, why not just trade down and have some fun? And the and the truth of the matter is, not typical of female psychology. It's not.
It's coming from an egocentric bias
right.
from a male questioner.
Right.
So it's
exactly.
It's really tough to understand that female psychology, that how not unimportant physical attractiveness is. Right. Obviously, physical attractiveness is important, but it does not operate in the female mating strategy in anything like the same way that it does from the male perspective. It's
right.
just a way different process.
Yeah.
And so this kind of idea that, yeah, there's this hot guitar playing number out there that is going to, you know, somehow fulfill the yearning to have a full pair bond. It's just not that. It's apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
What would you say for the women who are very high earners relative to their peers in that particular profession? Would you say they may be more likely to be higher testosteronized and therefore more casual mating oriented, and so that it can skew, you know, somebody's perspective if they kind of meet some of those girls and then they think, oh, well, all high earning women are like that.
Wait a second, I didn't hear you. So what you're talking about, what did you have a specific profession that you were talking about?
No, not specific.
Okay,
profession.
Just yeah. Okay, so and then
I'm
miss
if,
you.
I'm wondering if the higher earning females, that might be responsible for their personality. I mean, part of it may be their personality that's responsible for them being so successful. If they're
right.
And so if they're driven, if they're more maybe, you know, more disagreeable, therefore more testosteronized, and so they're more likely to have more casual mating encounters.
I doubt it.
More open.
I don't think so. Okay. No, I think you know what? That's an interesting question for some kind of curious young professor of social evolutionary psychology to see if he or she could run a little data on that. But if there was any truth in it, I would expect that the effect size would be very small. Mm. Most of that. Remember, anybody that's super high achieving is generally also going to be very high in conscientiousness. And so they're not going to be, their life is going to look like it's ruled by a great deal of conscientiousness. So they're probably not going to be sloppy about their mating behavior, not in the middle of a big six-figure career. So yeah, you don't see that. Go ahead, Jen.
Yeah. I think it's an intuitive kind of cliche that you see, you know, in pop culture, the kind of ball-busting lawyer who has the boy toy on the side, the sort of like there is this intuition because those women are by definition sort of unusual. And so you notice them more, both because they are high achieving, high earning in these high profile positions and career choices, and because they're sort of acting in this male-like way. So this, you know, as everyone knows, I'm a huge fan of reality dating TV shows, and this is a kind of a dynamic that you will see that gets a lot of advertising because it's so upside down that it's just inherently interesting, but that tells us that it's not very common.
Right. Yeah, I worked in I worked in the downtown county courthouse in Dallas for 5 years as the in-house psychologist for the probation department. And so I was running into all kinds of female lawyers, and there was no scuttlebutt about any of that going on. Not at all. I mean, it wasn't even entertaining conversation. That's just not how it was. If anything, they're walking around with big fat diamonds on because they're married to some shit-kicking litigator, you know, in the DA's office or in a private firm. You know, they're not out just quote having fun and being wild because they can. Yeah, not at all.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right.
It would be such a liability for them professionally. Just, you know, women are going to be in this particularly, especially if they are highly conscientious enough to achieve that level in their chosen profession, they're going to be very sensitive to the optics of getting themselves into something sloppy with some Jimmy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think Jen got it right. Perfect. I mean, what you were saying, I can't remember what you were just saying, Jen. It was perfect. I'll forget it. I lost it. I have to go back and listen.
Oh, just this, just now with this
question? No, yeah, like 45 seconds ago.
I don't know.
It's rare and therefore it's entertaining and titillating. That's where this is all coming from. Plus, your insight that the questioner has egocentric bias all over the place. Those two things put together to make this a titillating question that has no heart in it.
Yeah, I think you look at the, you know, if we were to look at the most high achieving women in, you know, politics and Supreme Court and elsewhere, these are very conservative, very, you know, family oriented females who are nonetheless very high achieving. And perhaps, you know, what looks like testosteronized behavior is just super high conscientiousness.
Yeah.
So I'll file this under.
And disagreeableness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I'll have to file this under wishful thinking. So you're telling me, that the Jimmies actually have to work hard and actually put in, you know.
Yeah. Well, actually, they're hitting on the waitress just like they should be.
Yeah. Well, and every Jimmy has his Cinderella fantasy that he's going to find a sugar mama. Like, this is, there's nothing wrong with
a really
with
hot
that.
One.
You know, it's good to have dreams. Yeah. So, I mean, the reason that it is a stereotype and it is kind of this titillating cliche because there's always the possibility. So, you know, keep aiming high.
There you go. Keep strumming the guitar. It's good practice for something.
That's right.
All right. Let's move on.
All right. We're going to pivot to a different topic here, and that is, dear doctors, I recently tried and failed to make my best friend into a trading partner. She needed money and seemed like she would be an asset to my business. I had started an academic proofreading company, and I hoped that she would become one of my most reliable editors because she told me she had great experience and lots of her own clients. After she did a few less than perfect jobs for me, I decided I would not be passing on any more work to her since I was losing money. I had to get her work re-edited by someone else. At the time, I didn't want to hurt her feelings by telling her the work wasn't good enough, so I paid her, said nothing, and hoped she would just get the idea. Several months later, she realized what has happened and cannot forgive me as a friend. For me, this was a purely business decision and was not meant to be personal. Even though I now feel bad for her and how I handled the situation, I can't accept that I should have done different. But I've now lost a friend over a commercial decision, and that feels super gross. Was this conflict of interests inevitable, and is there any way to salvage this friendship? Thank you for your wisdom, as always.
Yeah, good question. Jen, thoughts on this?
Oh, I mean, this is such a tough question. You know, the question is there, was this inevitable? I think in this kind of situation, always your best strategy is some version of Big Louie if you can pull it off, you know? So, and it might be too late to call upon a Big Louie, but maybe it's not. So we don't know all the details of this, but that's what occurs to me first, is if there is a way to sort of communicate this, perhaps if we could go back in time to, you know, hey, it's not me passing judgment on your abilities here, but it's, you know, it's a force bigger than me, you know, the other boss of the, you know, I have to give this job to somebody else because it's their niece or something, you know, there's got to be some sort of way to soften the blow in that way. But it sounds like that opportunity is passed, and we're now in this situation where she's taking something very personally, that she's feeling rejected by you as a friend, and she really, her feelings are not they're not really appropriate for the situation, because it is mm-hmm. just a commercial decision, and it wasn't a rejection of her as a friend. So she's kind of emotionally out of line, but she's also really hurt. So depending on what kind of rapport the two of you have and how long this friendship has been going on, this may just be a short-term storm too, that you might be able to get through as you go forward and be able to talk about this in a different sort of way. But I think the more you can remove it from, you know, a personal decision on her abilities that you were making, and make it more about, you know, the drift of the company, or you know, the direction things are going, or the other people wanted to do something else, and just depersonalize it as much as possible. That's going to soften the blow. So that's the first thing that occurs to me. But this is a tough situation mm-hmm. for sure, because I've been on kind of both sides of that equation, and it's really, really tough when you mix friendship and business and it goes sour like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Big Louie that occurred to me, Jen, that mm-hmm. and I don't know that this would, I have no idea exactly what the circumstances are, but one thing that we can sometimes do is say, listen, this was hard for me to deal with, but let me explain why. And the reasons why is that when it comes to this proofreading, you're very good. And you're right that you're very good, but you actually have to be outstanding for me to, you know, for our company to actually make it work. So it turns out that your work was very good, but it wasn't quite up to what it is that we need to survive. We got a lot of competition. Mm-hmm. The margins are really narrow. Okay. So we looked at it, you know what I mean? And we have a way that we assess this. And we had to look at it real carefully. And I unfortunately didn't step up and really tell you, because I was hoping that maybe you would get a little bit better, or maybe that it was good enough. But we kept coming back whereas, you know, even though you're absolutely, you know, you're professional level quality, but it wasn't good enough for what it is that we need to compete in. Okay, mm-hmm. So that kind of a story is, you know, it changes it from pass fail to, you know, essentially mm-hmm. A, B, C, and you're a B student, no shame, but we had to have A students. Okay.
We had many excellent applicants for the job. You know, we wish we could offer you a position. Yeah,
right.
That's basically how you're.
How we're trying to do it. We're trying to put ink in the water, and there's some truth in it. I'm sure she's better than an average college sophomore
sure.
English major. So, but the truth is, and she knows that she is. So that would probably ring fairly true, and it might get you through that mess. There's another little technique, depending upon how motivated you are. I mean, I completely agree with Jen that unfortunately, this gal is, she's twisted up, she doesn't really quite grasp this perspective. She doesn't actually believe that she's substandard. She's not thinking that. So instead, she's thinking that she got essentially betrayed, you know, by the coalition. And so we need to re-educate her as gently as possible about that. And then what we need to do is it depends upon how motivated you are, and it actually doesn't take that much energy. It takes a little bit of imagination and a little bit of diligence. It's what I call Chinese water torture. Okay? So when we've had a relationship go south, whatever it is, what we need to do is we need to drip little positive drips on their head. Okay? And that may go on for a while. So if this was a good friend, you might realize you might have a year of Chinese water torture where over the next year, five times, you're going to, on some legitimate occasion, their birthday, the summer solstice, whatever it is, there's some reason you're going to contact them and you're going to do something nice for them because you were thinking about it, okay, thinking about them. So, you know, maybe it's a little gift card to, I don't know, Barnes & Noble, where she can pick up a book about proofreading.
Don't write that on the card, though.
If you do write it on the card, make sure you spell it right, okay? So,
oh, my God.
So the point is... So the point is that... Yeah, if we drop little things on them like that, we'll see what we're doing is we're continually working on their CB, okay? And we're continuing by doing that, we're giving them a message that we are essentially sorry that they are upset and we understand it, and we actually don't hold their upsetness against them. We still consider them to be more benefit than cost, even though they weren't more benefit than cost within those narrow parameters of that job. Okay? So, but we drip that news on them, and we see whether or not if one day the flower opens. Now, I did this with a client that was being shunned by their family for something in prison. So this was somebody that was imprisoned, and I can't remember, I cannot for the life of me remember what the parameters were and what the dynamics were of this particular individual situation. I do remember what it took, though. It took a letter, a nice letter that they wrote for 2 years, okay? 2 years later, the Chinese water torture cracked open whoever it was on the other side. And then it resumed communication. So it took, you know, whatever that was, 26 letters or whatever it was. I can't remember exactly. It was something in that range, though. In other words, by focusing on the process rather than the outcome, I just said, listen, this is what you can do, okay? We can't do anything else. All we can do, you know, you can't buy them presents. You're in prison. You have no money, okay? There's nothing else. You have no other avenue other than you can write to them, and it's exceedingly likely that they're going to open it and that they're going to read it. So therefore, what you're going to do, I remember we had a simple little schematic. I think the party was, you know, the baby mama and the kid, something like that. I don't remember. It's starting to come back to me vaguely. So I think that I think what we did was we had the guy write something about, you know, something. Yeah, now I remember actually. We were looking all month. I said, I want you to look all month for anything that's funny that happens between the prisoners and the guards. Some goofy thing. Okay, you keep your eyes peeled for it, and then that becomes part of the story. Okay, and then listen on the prison yard for jokes. Okay, and you listen any good joke, you know, that's a good one, you're going to keep track of these things. And so every letter, and then look for any of these little periodicals that are around, that if there's any little cartoons, you're going to send a cartoon along with it. Boy, I'm remembering this all now, that's coming back to me. So the letter was, hi, how you doing? Then you're going to say something that good or interesting happened in the prison and what good food they had on Wednesday night. They had lasagna. And that, so in other words, we're not going to be moping and whining about anything. And then we're going to say something goofy and funny that happened. Either a prisoner looked silly or a guard looked silly, and that some little goofy situation. And then we're going to send a little cartoon, and then we're just going to sign off and say, hope very much you're doing well. Yeah, 2 years. Okay. 2 years later, that relationship cracked open and it reemerged. So that's what I call it. You just keep dripping the CB on their head. That's all you can do, people. Okay. You can't do anything else. So you just continue to signal that they have esteem with you, and we don't get angry and frustrated and pissy. And boy, you should have seen some of the letters that I looked at when prisoners were pissed at their family. Just these long, 8-page rails against how unfair the family is being, and how they this and how they that, and how they've been wronged. It's like, yeah, well, no wonder they haven't visited you. Okay, so instead we go this other direction. Think what we want to do. There's two principles that come to mind here. Principle number one is the issue of the cost benefit. The other principle is the principle of distortion. So Jen was referring to the fact that the woman on the other side of this has a distorted view of her value and a distorted view of the decision then to essentially terminate her and not use her, okay? So, and what it means about how our party values her in general. So did she lose value to our party in this process? Yes, we thought that she was better than she was, okay? However, our relationship and friendship with her was not predicated on how outstanding she was as a proofreader. So therefore, even though she wasn't as good as we thought, that's like finding out that Alan isn't as good a bowler as I thought he was. It's like, hey, I thought you were good. You were bragging about it. He brags about everything else. It just so happens that Alan was a very good bowler, but I just brought that out of a 50-year memory. But the point is that big deal. So it's really not that big a deal, and you're not thinking of it as a big deal, but we have a crisis that is now, we've got a distorted process now, and all that we can do is hope for the chance to de-distort the process. So we can do it with an opening letter where we describe the issue of excellence versus very good, and so I'm so sorry. And it was a hard decision, and I wasn't ever really clear, so I dragged on, and then it just sort of did it, by default, okay? And it wasn't right. And so we stand up and we make that apology because we're putting some ink in the water because it's actually she's so-so, and we needed her to be very good. But, so what? We give her a little grade inflation. Everybody else does. So so we do that, and therefore we de-distort, the issues of the crisis, which is that we're not really rejecting her because she's not that valuable as a human. It's extremely narrow, and it's not really particularly important to our overall evaluation of her. So if it turns out that she has a personality streak and she's going to hold it against us and she's not fair in the face of this kind of goodwill, then that's okay. Then she's giving us an opportunity to actually show us who she is, and then you probably won't value her as much.
Okay? That was a point I was going to make, is that yeah. That's another part of the de-distortion process.
Right.
If this continues to be the central defining feature of your friendship throughout the ages, and she really is not able to see past this, then this something on this order was going to happen the first time the two of you encountered any kind of conflict of interest. So it happened to take the form of your business interest. But this is showing you that she is, in terms of the fairness trading partner that we talk about, you were going to run into trouble sooner or later, mm-hmm. and that it's being held against you. So definitively is really, it's just an early, it's an early warning shot, and it's showing you who she is.
Beautiful. I would also say, go ahead, Jen.
Oh, no, you go ahead. I know you were wrapping around to a second point, too, but I have one more thing to add. So we'll
Got it. Okay, I will. When something like this happens, obviously we use Chinese water torture and we use the most direct possible avenue towards circumscribing whatever the issue is and trying to paint the relationship around that problem so that they understand it's not that important to us in the overall CB. So if that's how we feel, that's what we do, et cetera. Now, if it turns out that it's a mess that can't be fixed, then I have the following reaction. And that is, even though you can be irritated, that's okay. The real big reaction that you should have is one of relief. Okay, and that is, it's like, good, I'm really glad you showed me that now, not 7 years from now, when I've invested more time and energy in this relationship, and we might be playing for bigger stakes 7 years from now. And then it turns out that you've got characteristics that I didn't know were there. Okay, so the I said something on our internal discussion that Jen and I had with our Living Wisdom Library group a couple days ago. I just had figured out this is the year that Jen and I have known each other 5 years. I don't recall that we've ever had an argument. Okay, I actually can't remember one. Can you?
No, which is no. Amazing because it's not like we haven't had conflicts of interest.
Yeah, and it's also we got a number of possible conflicts of interest. We've waded into a lot of ground where there could be large conflicts of interest. We've had somewhat different how we see the world from male perspective, female perspective, you know, left-leaning versus right-leaning, libertarian-esque. And so we've got, you know, some political background rumblings that could cause conflicts of interest. But the answer is no. Never had 5 seconds of it. And so there's just been no bullshit at all. And so that lets me know, wow, if we've been through this water already, it's been, you know, mildly choppy enough that it's like there's no problem. This is a grand investment. It feels like a super great investment every day because it's just, you're just building constantly better goodwill of deeper water that one of the two of us or both of us might face in the future over something, you know? But if I make some offhand, really off-color sexist comment someday, it gets caught on national TV and we get, Jen's gonna throw me under the bus.
Oh, totally, in a second.
But if such a thing, if such a thing happened though, I would understand because I asked for it. But the point of all this is, yet sometimes if you run into a rough one and you can't fix it with excellent goodwill and a very decent strategy, then, you know, so be it. And that's and we make peace with that then. We need to do the best we can and we need to really think it through and make sure we've executed an extremely fair, good, sensitive strategy. If we've done that and it still fails, then it's like, okay, I can live with it. And that's how we get inner peace out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. The only other thing I'd add, there's some breadcrumbs in the way the question is asked that give me the feeling that she's in financial scarcity. She's like, there was something about how she needs the money and she's selling herself as being very successful, having lots of clients. But if that were true, then maybe she wouldn't be in this position of needing money. So this just file this under D distortion where maybe she needs to get through a period of time where she's feeling cornered financially and particularly stressed. And she was leaning on you as an insurance policy to get her through a hard time. And so that's part of why she's taking it personally. And that will, given, you know, as she reestablishes some financial security and she feels less cornered by her circumstances, this is not going to be as salient for her. So it's more hurtful now because this was her ticket to financial security and it's been taken away from her when she she thought she could count on you as a friend to get her through a tough time. And right. she's essentially confronting the fact that that insurance policy on the friendship is not paying out like she thought it was going to pay out because it got muddied by this business arrangement. So
right.
that is something that yes, if you keep the door open, keep the goodwill flowing, let her know that you're still there as a friend, the insurance policy is still valid, that it just, you know, it didn't apply in this particular precondition, then
yes.
as she moves into a different stage of her life, then the friendship could find its footing again.
Rockin' solid. Beautiful. That's I hadn't thought of that, but that you're right. It's right there, and she would be particularly sensitive, you know.
Totally, yeah.
Right,
yeah,
she's already being beat up by the market, so
and feeling really insecure about
yes.
it, and feeling, you know, really down on her talents probably. So we've got one of two things, and this goes back to this is why you do something like the. I'm not going to call it by the name you're calling it, which is terribly politically incorrect. So we
sorry about
give
that.
It a different name.
Well, as a kid, I watched James Bond movies. That's sorry.
but that sort of process of just keeping the door open and you know reaffirming that you're there for her. We don't know. So that is basically the experiment that you do to discover whether it's hypothesis one is true. She's, you know, she thinks she's really hot shit and she's been rejected and it's not fair, or whether hypothesis two is true, which is that she's feeling really scared and really financially insecure and that she was counting on a friend who didn't come through for her when she thought that he was, or if it's some combination of those two or something else. You have to kind of, you know, engage in the openness and staying present for her to discover what the truth of the relationship is. But you will discover the truth of the relationship over time. That's like the fundamental principle of all relationships, is the truth emerges over time as long as you stay in a space that facilitates truth telling.
Mm-hmm. I got a question. So are you telling me that I can't call the chapter Chinese water torture? Is that what you're telling me?
Is this our first fight? Are we having our first fight on
no,
air?
No, I'm just asking. I got my answer.
No, we can't call that. No. Come up with, you've got a powerful right brain, Doug. You can come up with a better name than that.
All right.
Well, that's wonderful.
All right, Nathan.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you. So, Dr. Hawk, if I understand you correctly, you're kind of beautifully tying this into the first question by essentially getting her to her friend to understand to hate the game, not the player. Did I get that right?
It's a stretch, but I'll give it to you.
There you go.
All right. Overshot a little bit. Close enough. Yeah.
Good.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Fantastic, Nathan. We'll see y'all soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.